From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Summer. The word itself creates dreamy images of picnics, beaches, backyard barbecues, a time for families to come together and relax. But when both parents work outside the home, the dream of summer can be a financial and logistical nightmare. Today in The Exchange, navigating summer, the realities for today's families. And later in the hour, we take a pause in our Race for the First series on the 1st Congressional District with a check-in on the 2nd District, where three Republicans are vying for the nomination to take on incumbent Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer. Right now, though, let's hear about your family's summer juggle. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests in studio. KJ Dell'Antonia is here, writer and author of a parenting blog, former lead editor and writer for the Motherlode blog at the New York Times. KJ is also the author of the forthcoming book, How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. And KJ, it's really nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Also with us, Jessica Leahy, writer for many publications, including the New York Times and the Atlantic. Jessica is the author of the best-selling book, The Gift of Failure. She also has a blog and a writing podcast with KJ. And Jessica, it's really good to see you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, and Jessica, I want to start with you. What's the image of summer? Ah, you just say the word and you want to go, ah. What's the image that a lot of parents hold as this season approaches?
Oh, it's that parenting nostalgia,
right?
Image of the children charging through the woods with, you know, a stick to whittle and a fire to make. And, you know, that's generally speaking not how it looks for a lot of parents these days.
What does it look like?
Well, it's a much busier time. We feel like we need to have them enrolled in camps. We can't take the whole summer off and you know, be there to patch up our kids when they come in from playing in the woods. You know, generally speaking, parents have lined up camps. They've lined up lessons. They've lined up very complicated and delicate carpool schedules to make sure that all of it works. But it's expensive, and it's also a real burden on parents to find all of these places to send their kids while they're at work.
Well, I've been there, done that. I can picture the Matrix, you know, who's picking up this day and who's picking up that day and which camp starts when and so forth. But that image, KJ, where does that come from? You know, the season of popsicles and beaches and backyard barbecues.
Well, I think a lot of us remember that as our own childhood. And part of what is different today is that more children live in two working parent homes and more children live in single homes than was the experience when most parents today were growing up. So even if we're not remembering stomping through the woods with a, you know, and whittling, we're remembering the sprinkler outside of the apartment building. I mean, at least there was somebody at home or somebody around. It might not have been our mom. It might have been somebody else's mom. Also, we remember a time when kids could be more free and there was less judgment over letting your kids run wild through the streets. So, you know, you might have been able to leave your kid at home alone just knowing they could check in with a neighbor, which is not something that's really acceptable today. It can get you in a lot of trouble.
Well, in fact, we did a show a couple years ago on that family in Maryland that I think they had their 8-year-old and 10-year-old go to the park by themselves and the neighbors, you know, got all up in arms.
Well,
and
there
so
was
forth.
A woman not long ago who was arrested for leaving her 9-year-old in a park. She was working a shift at McDonald's. It was summer. The kid didn't have school. Park was across the street from the McDonald's. The child was taken into a care for a while. It was a big deal.
Well, talking about realities of today's families, let me throw a couple numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics at both of you. 62% of married couples, never mind single parent households, but 62% of married couples with kids under 18 both work outside the home. So that's one. And then the labor force participation rate, that's not my term, that's the Bureau's, for moms with kids under 18, 71%. So 71% of moms with kids under age 18 work outside the home. And even moms of the littlest kids under age 6, it's 65%. So the question, Jessica, I'll throw it to you first. It's clear that the vast majority of parents with kids at home are working. So why do we all of a sudden clear the decks for the kids for 10 weeks, 11 weeks, 12 weeks, when the vast, vast majority of parents are working?
Well, the answer for a long time now has been, oh, it was, you know, the agrarian calendar was what really led this big, long summer vacation. And that's simply not true. There was a period of time when kids would go to school much longer. I believe in 1842, kids were in school for 248 days a year, as opposed to the 180 that
we do now.
Wow,
that's a big difference.
Yes, it's a huge difference. But there was this feeling that teachers needed time to prepare, that there needed to be a bigger break for kids during the summer. And it really actually was not related to the agrarian calendar at all. It just sort of went in that direction. But now the conversation about year-round schooling has come back. It's a discussion that teachers are having again, mainly because of the burden that summer vacation, it sounds crazy to say burden that summer vacation puts on teachers, because everyone has this image of teachers running free through the woods in the summer, just cheering that they're on vacation all summer long, which is actually not how it generally goes for teachers. But there's a lot of reteaching that has to happen at the beginning of the year in order to get kids back to the place they were when we left them in June. So there's a lot of work around having a summer break and a lot of burden on teachers and burden on kids to sort of relearn a lot of information at the beginning of the year. And the problem is that burden is actually greater for poor kids than it is for rich kids.
Well, we should definitely talk about the summer mm-hmm. slide in a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. But KJ, you wrote a piece for the New York Times a couple of years ago. I think it was called The Families Who Can't Afford Summer,
right,
or The Costs of Summer, or something like that.
Yes, it's The Families Who Can't Afford Summer. You know, the entire school calendar is geared towards the idea that children are growing up with one parent at home. The fact that school ends at 3 is geared towards the idea that kids are growing up with one parent at home. So much of our entire societal and cultural expectations around parents are geared towards the idea that kids are growing up with one parent at home. That's
even
not
with those numbers I cited from the BLS.
Yeah,
the vast, vast, vast majority of parents with kids are working outside the home.
But there is very little that is structurally available to help those parents. For the ones who need help with their childcare, whose jobs don't provide the kind of money that's going to let them. And some of these, ironically enough, are daycare workers. I've talked to so many daycare workers who can't afford their own daycare. There's very little. When there is subsidized childcare in a community, it's not a promise. You qualify for subsidized childcare, but we might not have any. And most of the time, it's not available. Most parents who qualify for that kind of help can't even find it during the school year, let alone during the summer. So when it comes to summertime, there's this huge increase in kids left, it's called self-care. And because of what we just talked about, where we are, you know, there's a big judgment and possibly the risk of getting your kids taken away from you if they're outside, most of those kids are inside, in front of their screens, and basically told by their parents, okay, I mean, you can envision this. Sorry, 8-year-old and 6-year-old, I had to go to my shift. You guys can't put your nose out of this apartment until I get back. There's also people get their grandmothers to help, people get their neighbor to help, lots and lots of working together and building a village. But sometimes that village doesn't really look quite as ideal as you'd hope.
Well, and the image that you painted of the 7-year-old, 6-year-old, and 8-year-old, you know, mom or dad says, look, I have to go do my shift at McDonald's. Don't leave the house.
That's right.
And they're in front of the screen all day. It's so far from that image that you painted,
right,
Jessica, in the beginning. And it can't be good for kids to sit inside all day on a beautiful summer day. My goodness.
We're picturing these kids running through the woods and getting exercise. But the truth is that, for example, minority children gain weight twice as fast during the summer than they do during the school year. And partially that comes down to the fact that a lot of kids depend on healthy food coming from their school system or coming from somewhere outside of the home. And so when you...
And running around playing at
exactly.
school.
Exactly. And so when you leave kids to their own devices during the summer, and, you know, frankly, there are a lot of families who are having trouble paying for food during the summer, you end up in a situation where kids are getting either sort of uneven access to healthy food or just sort of on their own to eat whatever they can find in the pantry.
Well, and some kids do get their good meals at school, so...
Mm-hmm.
even though they're eating at home in the summer, you're saying it's not the high quality or the higher quality food that right. they would get at school, like a real meal.
Well, and the problem is during the summer, only one out of seven of the kids that do rely on subsidized food from schools, for example, during the school year, are getting subsidized food during the summer. So we're leaving a lot of kids and a lot of families in a situation where they don't have access to great food during the summer.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. Let's hear your stories about the costs of summer. As the school year winds down, many parents are winding up trying to figure out childcare arrangements for those many weeks of summer when their kids are off, but they are not. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's hear from you. And Russell sent us an email. Russell says, it is a logistical nightmare. It's amazing how many summer day camps don't start before 8 or 8:30. And if you're lucky to find one, they generally charge extra for early drop-off. And there's quite a few that only go till noon or 1 in our area, the Upper Valley. Russell, I hear you. I've often looked at these summer camp rundowns, KJ, and, you know, we start at 10 and end at 2. And I'm thinking, okay, so what am I supposed to do with that?
Right. No, this is one of the unifying challenges of parenthood. This is the moment when it all comes together for you know, nearly all of us, that this is the tough time of year. We've got a statistic here that people spend about $288 per kid per week. If you look nationally, people will talk about $1,000 over the course of the summer.
And that actually doesn't sound like a lot to me, based on the costs of some of these camps.
Right. That's an average, and that includes people who are spending zero because they have zero. It's an enormous challenge.
Do you want to jump in, Jessica?
Well, and the other issue is that when they talk to families about would you like to be able to do something with your kids during the summer, 51% of families who didn't have their kids engaged in some sort of summer program said, yes, we would if we could afford it. And that's, you know, I think there's just a lot of kids left out of the picture of constructive programs in the summer, programs that actually add to kids getting outside and getting exercise, kids learning during the summer, that sort of thing, exposing kids to new experiences.
Yeah, well, Russell, thank you for the email. Again, you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. KJ, in your piece that I mentioned, the families that can't afford summer, you asked the question, should we just get rid of it? These long summer vacations. I mean, we've talked about what a struggle it is for people especially who can't afford these expensive camps. But even for people who can, it's this weird juggle of timing and carpooling and so forth.
Interestingly, most of the people that I talked to, even the ones that can't afford it, still didn't want it to go away.
Really?
So the obvious solution, and one that would sort of help with the summer slide question, would be what's, you know, called year-round school, where it's, you know, they have several breaks of shorter duration. But realistically, as I talk to parents, that doesn't help. It moves the problem. It redistributes the problem. But do we really think that suddenly we're going to have more than 180 days of school a year in this country? Probably not. Maybe it's 200 days. That still leaves an awful lot of days. So really what summer does is highlights a national problem that it goes on year-round, which is the lack of affordable childcare based on the number of hours that children are in public schools.
So affordable and high quality.
High quality would be lovely, but I think there are a lot of people out there who would settle for just safe.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Catherine that relates to something you just said, KJ. Catherine says, what will it take for us to reorganize the school year to a year-round schedule with periodic one-week or two-week breaks? Catherine asks, are there practical efforts in New Hampshire or elsewhere to make this happen? And KJ, I think in your piece you did mention that Britain and Germany have six-week breaks.
Right. So they have a shorter time off. They also typically have a longer school schedule. European countries, including Britain and Germany, also typically put their sports and activities for kids. They're part of the school. So the entire way that a kid's life is organized in those countries is different. They leave the house at 8. They, you know, end up at 5. And it's not like they're in class all day suffering. They have you know, they have their sports, they have their activities, they have different things structured because those societies are set up for the idea that perhaps there isn't a parent waiting at
home
just for
maybe,
the child.
Like the 70% or so of American families. Yeah, go ahead, Jessica.
Well, access to activities has been a problem even when kids are in school, because when kids get out of school at 3, their ability, for example, where we live, our town does not have a high school, and there is no public transportation for our children to get to that high school. So if someone needs to get to an activity, if someone needs to be shuttled, you know, back and forth, that's going to fall on that burden. Is going to fall to a parent or some very, as we mentioned before, very delicate and complicated, you know, chessboard of drivers. So that kids being able to do sports, kids being able to do activities after school ends up being something that's actually quite a privilege if you have the ability to arrange that kind of transportation and care.
Right. So we have the issue that the library has become the de facto after school care where we live. And, you know, nobody's paying them to do that. So it's an interesting problem. And it's one many communities share.
So kids will just hang out at the library after school because no one's home.
Yeah, there's nowhere else
safe
to go.
There.
Well, and they can walk to the library, but maybe they can't walk home.
And the librarians are saying, we're not child care
workers. It depends on, you know, sometimes it's okay, some places it's okay. But again, we just don't recognize the need for this.
Things have changed in libraries, too. Now, what's been interesting is to watch, I talked to a lot of librarians about this. What is their responsibility to handle loud kids, to handle disruptive kids, to handle the stuff that comes up among teenagers in the afternoon when they're on their own at the library? And the problem is it's not as if the librarians have a list of names to call and say, come and get your kid, they're being disruptive. So the librarians I've spoken to have taken a couple of different measures. Some have made teen rooms that are sort of set off by themselves so that those kids can have a space that's separate from the rest of the library. But generally speaking, librarians have had to say, yeah, we need to be able to have the ability to say, you can't stay here because you're causing a problem. And then parents seem to get upset as if there's some sort of obligation the libraries have to take care of their children.
You know, better the library than, you know, behind the convenience store doing who knows what.
Absolutely. And there are so many interesting ways to think about resolving this problem. I mean, we can think about providing higher quality childcare, and we can think about changing where we have our after-school activities. We can also think about it from the other angle. Why is full-time work structured the way that it is? Why does it have to be from 8 to 5? Or, you know, if you're a shift worker, why are your shifts not perhaps set up according to what kid hours might be? Why don't we provide better support for parents with young children who don't want to work full-time because they want to be home for these hours? But, you know, you can't. If you have a minimum wage or low income job, you can't feed your family and take care of your family without working those extra hours. There's all kinds of ways to look at this, but really what it all comes down to is that in a country where we're really, really, really loud about family values, we don't do much in the way of supporting those families.
Well, a couple emails have come in. Here's Timothy, who says, shifting the school schedule away from the coldest months of the year and replacing them with a shorter summer break will decrease the tax burdens, heating, busing, plowing the roads. So, Timothy, thank you for the idea. Here's someone else who sent an email, didn't give a name. The issue is compounded for parents of kids with special needs who can't manage the typical day camp environment. My son has autism, and we are headed into the 18th summer of scrambling to find care providers for him. Thank you for that email as well. We'll talk more about summer scrambling in just a moment and offer some possible solutions. You can join us as well. 1-800-892-6477. Thank you very much for those emails. You can join us as well. Send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the high cost of summer for those many American families with two parents working outside the home. As we're hearing, summer can be an expensive, stressful juggle for the vast majority of American parents who do work outside the home. We're talking about that. And a little bit later, we'll check in on New Hampshire's second congressional district race. Let's hear from you now. How do you navigate your family's hopes and realities and costs of 10 weeks of summer vacation? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Jessica and KJ, let's go right back to our listeners. And Senita is calling from Chester. Hi, Senita. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Go ahead.
I stayed home for 14 years and I went back to full-time work 2 years ago. And I took for granted staying home, how easy it was to plan summer. And then now I'm always scrambling to figure out what to do. My kids are older. And I don't know what to do. Like, it's too expensive to put them in camps. My kids, the oldest drive, so it does make my life easier, but still.
How old are your kids, Senita?
So my oldest just turned 19. I have a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 12-year-old.
Yeah, wow. That is a juggle and a scramble. And I remember, Senita, probably the toughest summers for me were with 14 and 15-year-olds, because they're too old to go to that, silly day camp that they've gone to forever. But they're not old enough to work in many instances. I mean, and they tried. So it's a tough time, KJ. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a real challenge. They often say no to the camps that you can afford. They think that they can stay home alone. What parents that I've talked to have done a couple of things. They've worked together within their community or on their block. One way that a kid that age can maybe work would be to help out another parent whose kids are 6 and 8. Maybe they could do it in tandem. So, 2 12-year-olds taking care of 2 6 and 8. 8-year-olds, that's not too young. I think there are people that would say it was. But then you've got sort of a team of kids doing something, and they're not just on their screens all the day because they're having to entertain these other kids. It's just hard getting the kids involved and figuring out what they're going to do all day and then keeping on top of what they're doing all day is, I guess, it's kind of the least expensive solution.
Well, and they know what they want to do all day.
Yeah.
Which is stay inside and play on the computer, right?
Probably. So. Most of them.
Go ahead, Jessica.
Well, I was just...
Older kids. It's a challenge.
Yeah, older kids are a challenge. And believe me, we did some talking in our household about how old you have to be in order to get a job, because my younger child, but who is now sort of in that big gap of the teenage years right before, he's really old enough to have like a paid job, but he's too old to be doing the kid stuff that he doesn't want to be doing anymore. He said, can't there be ways for me to, be like an intern somewhere? Can't I go? And we were talking about the fact that, that's just a really hard thing to work out, because you're asking another person to take responsibility for your child. Both, in terms of liability and in terms of hours. But
plus, you have to get them there.
Exactly.
Still.
Yes.
I mean, even if they get a job at age 14, unless you live somewhere with a nice public transit system, which is not the common thing in our state, unless they can walk, there you are.
Well, and even those kids, 13, 14, 15, again, that's a tricky age, who want to work, Jessica, mm-hmm. Employers are pretty fussy these days. I mean, I remember asking around when my kids were that age, and they, understandably said no, 16 only, or in many cases, 18 mm-hmm. only. Mm-hmm. So you've got a 15-year-old who's raring to go, make some money this summer instead of being at this dumb day camp that mom always sends me to, and they can't do it.
It can be really hard to take on the burden of training someone just for a couple of months so that they can get by and run a cash register for a couple of months. Luckily, we have, in our area, we have, places like country stores and places like that that have been really supportive of kids in the community and wanting to help kids in the community work. But those can be really difficult to find. And as KJ mentioned, it can be very difficult to get those kids to those places. We live in an area where it can be very difficult to get from place to place if you don't have access to a car.
Some of the day camps for younger camps kids will take junior counselors. So your child may not be getting paid, but you may not be paying, and so maybe you could pay. Maybe you could pass some of that savings on.
Yeah, well, Sunita, good luck, and yes. We really appreciate your call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, I want to circle back with both of you to this email I read just before the break from this person who didn't give a name. The issues compounded, this person says, for parents of kids with special needs who can't manage the typical day camp environment. So, you know, as tough as it is, a scramble, a juggle that we've been talking about for most families, KJ, it's especially tough when your kid has special needs and school is out.
It really is, because the camps don't have the same obligation that the public school does. They don't have to. They don't have to accept every child. And if a child presents too many difficulties, they may just simply say no. They can also call you and say, you know, we're sorry, this has happened to me. Your child is not participating, and we do not have the staff to, you know, sort of one-on-one this child. So it just compounds the whole issue. And those are families that are usually already struggling with both the school and the after-school activities. But at least
the schools, as you said, are obligated to provide the supports necessary.
Right.
Go ahead, Jessica.
I'd love to mention there's a wonderful resource for this. There was an article at acacamps.org. It's the American Camping Association, acacamps.org. There are actually articles there on helping, for example, your kid with autism have the best possible experience at a camp. And one of the nice things about ACA Camps, American Camping Association, is that they have resources for all accredited camps in this country. And there are accredited camps that are specifically for kids with special needs, specifically for kids who, you know, have very specific needs and wants during the summer. And so it's well worth your time to go peruse their website and look for specific camps that might fit your kids' needs best.
How expensive is your... You're both smiling at me. How expensive is, Jessica, start with you, your typical, you know, local New Hampshire, reasonable
right.
day camp?
So KJ mentioned earlier from the National Summer Learning Association, this figure of $288 per child per week. That is actually only among parents who are paying for the program. So that doesn't include that zero figure. But what was really interesting is recently I saw a Facebook post from a friend, and I happen to know this friend. You know, her husband is a very, very well paid physician. And she was complaining about the price of summer camps. And she was complaining about, you know, she was here talking about figures like $1,000 a week for a kid. So whether you're talking $288 a week, you're talking $1,000 a week, it's still, that is a huge amount of money to pay, especially when you have more than one child. I do know I was talking to someone, a town manager recently, talking about some of the financial support that can be available for families during the summer. Many towns, including the town I live in, has a town foundation where you can apply for help for some of the local programs during the summer. So ask around, ask your town at your town offices, go to acacamps.org and look at some of those financial resources that might be available to you.
I see. So if you're a moderate or low-income family and you're looking at what the town rec department mm-hmm. offers for summer camp, you think, okay, that might be good, but I've got two kids.
Right.
It's a lot per week. I don't make that much money. You can apply for assistance?
Some towns have, not only can you apply for assistance, some towns have, if you have four children or more, we will reduce the cost by X. But some towns do have foundations within the town. And it's, you know, I love giving to town foundations because it's a way of supporting your community and
right.
everyone in your community. They give college scholarships, they give summer program scholarships, that kind of thing.
Do you want to jump in, KJ?
I was just, so affordable daycare, which includes camp during the summer, is considered to be anything less than 10% of your income. And if you look at $288 a week, that's That's a lot. I mean, that's not less than 10% of almost anybody's income. I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but certainly statistically, some of the families that I talked to when I was preparing my article were hitting up to numbers like, you know, 23% of their weekly income, 40-some percent of their weekly income.
Wow, that's a
lot. Well, and but the choice is to lose the job.
It's worth noting also that summer programs that are part of your ability to work are tax deductible. So, and part of those that under, not tax deductible, but under those child care expenses,
you get a credit.
Exactly.
Right.
So, if you have to use money during the summer so that you can go and work, you know, just remember that, that's a part of the tax process as well.
Up until age 13, and then they decide that your kid's old enough to stay.
Exactly, and then we're stuck in that.
Might still get arrested for it, but they're old.
Exactly.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about the summer juggle, the summer scramble, how working parents manage 10 weeks of summer when their kids are off and they are definitely not off for 10 weeks. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter, you can respond there too. It's NHPR Exchange. And Sherry's calling in from Epsom. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that with the advent of the internet, a lot of jobs that you wouldn't expect have become sort of flexible, and sometimes they aren't advertised as such, but I actually was a homeschooling mom, and I did a lot of designing my jobs to be at home, but I became a working mom who also homeschooled, and both my husband and I basically approached our companies and gave a formal appeal to flex our hours or work part-time from home or work full-time from home. The job that I work for now, it's moving toward a model of training remote to work remote, and I hear that that's becoming more common. So I think that sometimes people don't know that they could actually make a plan and an appeal to their company, depending on what their job was, to flex their hours around the kids' schedule.
Yeah, and maybe some people are afraid to ask, Sherry, you know?
Right.
They don't want to seem like, oh, I'm a slacker, I want to work at home. Thank you so much for the call. KJ, before we got on the air this morning, you and I were talking about how you sort of manage and juggle with your four children.
Right, I've always had flexible jobs. It is great that they ask. It is great that they put themselves out there, because here's an interesting way that people often deal with this, especially people who are in higher income jobs or white collar jobs. They hide, they mask the fact that they're leaving a little bit early to deal with summer. They, you know, throw a coat over the back of the desk. They come back. They just don't mention it. It's people even call it passing. So it's this pretense that I am working every bit as hard as, you know, those childless workers in the next office. And the result is that the childless workers and the lower workers that don't have kids don't see the, you know, people asking for flexibility. And what you don't see is really hard to ask for. So if you're in a position where you can ask and be open about, hey, I'm heading out for my kid's doctor's appointment. You know, I was in at 8, I'm heading out at 3. See you tomorrow at 7 a.m. or whatever. Just make it open what you're doing. It's hard to start doing that because you really feel like your bosses may not like it and people may perceive you differently, but it does so much for the other parents around you. And if we all start doing it, then we won't be perceived differently, because really, most people are in this boat at some point in their lives.
It is tough to make the ask.
Yep.
Especially when most people don't do it.
Right. Then I think more people are flexing and juggling and squeezing. And if you look, there's research that lots of men are doing this too, but they really don't say anything.
Do you want to jump in, Jessica?
Well, I was just thinking when KJ mentioned sort of how we make it work, I was just thinking about the fact that when I first had children and my friends first had children, we just, as we were talking about before, the creating these dances where you hand off a kids. So, you know, when I, one of my best friends, we created a schedule where my teaching schedule and her teaching schedule were different. And we had to both go to our bosses and both had to say, look, I'm relying on this other human being to take care of my children. So she's going to be as flexible as possible so that I can be as flexible as possible. So here are our parameters. And that requires that you have the ability to speak up and say, you know, I need to work only these hours because I need to take care of her children so that she can take care of my children. And it's a very delicate dance. And it often feels like we're asking for a lot, but we're not. We're asking to be productive part of the workforce, given that we're having children.
Well, and we're raising the next generation.
Exactly.
I mean, so.
Yes, it's important work that is so taken for granted.
But you do kind of feel bad. You know,
you
I really
do.
Appreciate Sherry. Like, you feel like you're sort of saying, ooh, I hope you don't mind. But in a way, mm-hmm. Why should you feel bad? You're raising the next generation of Americans.
You shouldn't feel bad. We want people to do this. And we, you know, there are so many ironies here. We want people to work. No one wants people on public assistance. You know, everyone wants President Trump wants our economy to grow by some really large number that I have momentarily forgotten in the next 3 years. Well, you know, to do that, it's better if we can all go to work. And it's really hard to go to work if you're the possessor of, you know, the equivalent of a 10-pound sack of flour that must be monitored 24/7, which is what you get when you give birth to a child. We don't take that into effect. And it's much easier to return to the workforce more productively if you've been given the kind of leave where you can take care of your 10-pound sack of flour without, like, then having to go and search for a new job at the end of it. I mean, it's crazy how much we don't do.
Well, and getting back real quick before I let you both go, because we're going to switch gears after the break and talk about the second congressional district race. Let's talk a little bit more. And Jessica, you alluded to this, so I'm going to go to you. Mm-hmm. The summer slide, and you're a teacher. You know, this is families who can't afford these enriching summer camps and can afford a wonderful, you know, grandma type to come in and read to the kids all day. So there's the summer slide. They sit in front of their screens all day from, you know, 8 a.m. until 4 p.m.
Right. And just sort of defining our terms, summer slide is about the amount of learning that is lost over the summer. And it is a very real thing. Most students lose about 2 months of math skills over the summer.
2 months.
2 months of mathematical skills every summer. And low-income children typically lose another 2 to 3 months in reading. And a lot of that comes down to books available at home. We know that kids who have a lot of books just in the home tend to have a much higher vocabulary. They have many more words at their disposal. And that kids in poverty tend to suffer more loss during the summer. And also, this is a time, I'm a huge, huge fan of Twitter for education, because a lot of teachers are on Twitter. It's as a profession, teachers are one of the largest users of Twitter. And right now, the discussion on Twitter is about starting to think about next year. And get this, 9 in 10 teachers spend at least 3 weeks reteaching lessons at the beginning of the next school year.
To make
so
up
teachers
for that
are already
slide.
Saying, look, well, my first 3 weeks, my first month is really about getting us back to where we were before we left. And that's a lot of school days lost to what could be, you know, new learning.
Wow. There's a lot more we could have talked about. We have to wrap it up here. I really appreciate both of you coming in. Jessica, it's good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jessica Leahy, writer for many publications, including the New York Times and The Atlantic, author of the best-selling book, The Gift of Failure. KJ, great to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
KJ Dell'Antonia, writer and author of a parenting blog, former lead editor and writer for the Motherlode blog at the New York Times. Her forthcoming book is How to Be a Happier Parent. Now, coming up, we take a pause in our Race for the First series about the first congressional district. We'll head over to the second congressional district to see what's happening in that campaign. So stay with us for that. It's all coming up. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.